Greetings, friends. I'm John Haspel. This is a recording of our Tuesday evening Dhamma class from Cross River Meditation Center in Frenchtown, New Jersey, on July 10th, 2018. My Dhamma talk and our Sangha discussion is the second this week on the Vipalasa Sutta, a sutta on fabrications. If you find benefit from this talk, please consider a donation at becoming-buddha.com. Thank you. Peace. So the Vipalasa Sutta, a sutta on fabrications. I should point out that, like most of my Dhamma articles, they're based on Thanissara Bhikkhu's translations, and most of those are from Access to Insight website, and he has a website now too that's kind of a mirror of that called dhammatalks.org. And there's also 90% of my articles are based on his translations. And as I state, I think almost in every article, that I make contextual edits to minimize repetition. If you think that the repetition that's left is a lot, you read the original. And to maintain contextual relevance to dependent origination and Four Noble Truths, and also to modernize the verbiage a little bit. And this, the reason I'm bringing this up now, in Thanissara's translation, he uses the word perversions as opposed to translation, fabrications, which I found odd and a little bit confusing, because that word is not, I haven't found it used anywhere in either his translations or any other reference that might be appropriate. The reference is to fabrications. If you look up even a dictionary definition of perversions, one of the descriptors will be fabrications. The meaning is pretty close to the same, though. In that way, a fabrication or a perversion is a concoction or a putting together of disparate and non-related facts, and facts in quotation marks, and then coming to a conclusion from that. And so at the Buddha awakened to, as state and dependent origination, from ignorance as a required or a requisite condition come mental fabrications. You could as nearly accurately say from ignorance as a requisite condition comes perverted thinking in that way. But consistently throughout most of the literature, the word that's used, or the two words that are used, are fabrications or mental fabrications. So it's really just in that idea of maintaining consistency and not create further confusion as to, is there a difference between perversions and fabrications? I hope I didn't create more confusion with that description.
That's interesting.
Yeah, and since I've gone this far, I might as well say that, and I think those of you that have been reading my Dhamma articles realize this, that there's a difference between a scholarly translation and the charge behind that, meaning that you want to, when you're doing a scholarly translation, your charge is to be as close to the original, which is sometimes Pali, sometimes it's German, sometimes it's even Chinese that the translator's using as a base. But there's no translator that can't help but moderate that based on their own understanding of what the Buddha was teaching. And if you look at all the different schools, the conclusions that many people make are quite different and often significantly different. I found that Thanissara Bhikkhu's translations are the most consistent in their exposition, but also consistent with what the Buddha taught. But even then, and again, remember this is a scholarly translation, sometimes the contextual relevancy to dependent origination and Four Noble Truths is lost in that translation. And so I hope to maintain that through every one of my contextual edits, if I can use the word. What's most important, and the thing that struck me when I started studying the suttas directly, is the consistent message that the Buddha presented, even in suttas that you had a hard time making the connection until you understood that everything the Buddha taught was in the context of dependent origination and Four Noble Truths. And of course, this is no exception. The Vipalasa Sutta, fabrications. The Buddha's words, friends, there are four fabrications of perceptions of the mind, of views. Those three characteristics refer to a singular quality of a confused mind. These four fabrications are confusing permanence with regard to impermanence, confusing pleasant with regard to stressful, confusing self with regard to not self, and confusing the attractive with regard to what is unattractive. So the point that's being made here is that there is, in reality, there's no connection between pleasant and unpleasant, attractive and unattractive, stressful and not stressful, and as we could take it further, not self and self. And it's really like the misapplication of dependent origination or dependent co-arising, that the word, the modifier is used often to make it interdependent co-arising, and there's no relationship between the two words. But misunderstanding and misconstruing a relationship is really the problem. The problem of misunderstanding impermanence is that we try to make what is impermanent permanent. We try to make our views of what really don't constitute a self a self. We try to make what is ultimately unattractive attractive so that we can maintain our connection to it, our clinging, our self-reference to it. Is that clear? Please tell me if it's not, because I'm hoping to make it more clear, not more confusing.
It sounds like very much like a perversion.
Yes.
It's really a perversion.
Yep. And in that case, I guess the word is more appropriate, but when you think about it,
yeah,
we're fabricating an understanding or a misunderstanding of permanence and impermanence because we're tying together things that are not meant to be related to each other. Mm. Impermanence is simply impermanence. There's nothing... You can't find any permanence in impermanence. You can't find any self in not self. You can't find any attractiveness in what is unattractive, unless you change your view. You go from a wrong view to a right view. Conversely, in the saving grace, if I can use the religious term, we can go from wrong view to right view by seeing these things clearly. That's the point of the sutta, and that's why I think it's such a wonderful sutta.
Yeah, to me, it looks like if you come at this the concept of fabrications for the first time, it would on first blush be easier to use the word perversion than to use the word fabrication.
Okay, Tanisaro, I guess you're right.
Yeah,
I think you're not here.
Because
it takes a while to get to the underlying ideas of fabrications, whereas perversion is not clear. Yeah, this is, you just perverted.
I think you're absolutely right, and I would bet that that's why Tanisaro used it. And again, it's not consistent, but you know, fabrications, one of the reasons why I'm teaching this is fabrications can be misunderstood, but everybody understands what perverted thinking would be. So, but I'm going to stay with fabrications.
I've never heard it said as perversions in like any of the things, though we've been gives it that juice.
Yeah. And in that way, it is a little bit more accurate.
Malappropriated.
Yes. So, these are the four perversions. These are the four fabrications. We all know what we're referring to now. These are the four fabrications of perception of the mind of views. And these are the four qualities of mind that are not fabricated or not perverted. Knowing impermanence as impermanence. Knowing stress as stress. Knowing not self as not self. Knowing what is unattractive as unattractive. What the Buddha is saying is we need to stop romancing things. You know, stress is stress, no matter how you look at it. How did the Buddha describe stress? Birth is stressful, aging is stressful, sickness is stressful, death is stressful. Not getting what is desired is stressful. Getting what is undesired is stressful. We all know that, don't we? But we don't want to know it. We don't want to know stress is stress. We don't want to admit that what is stressful. Because all of those things we feel like we have no control over. And because we've now created a self-referential view in our life, we feel like we need to have control over it. But like the Buddha says in the Anatta Lakkhana Sutta, if you don't have any control over it, how could it be a self? How could it? Doesn't make any sense. These are the four qualities of mind that are free of fabrication. Perceptions, the mind, and views are fabricated when perceiving permanence and impermanence, when perceiving pleasure in what is stressful, when perceiving self in what is not self, when perceiving attractiveness in the unattractive, which is really the heart of the problem, isn't it? It's what follows from a mind rooted in ignorance of the way things are. these beings that do so are destroyed by wrong view. These beings have lost their minds. These beings are bound to ignorance, and these beings will find no rest, wandering aimlessly from birth to death. Another word that's often used from that wandering aimlessly is wandering aimlessly in samsara, which is related very closely to the word sankhara. Sankhara is the Pali word that can mean fabrications, perversions, concoctions, wrong views, conditioned mind. And so you see how it's all interrelated and how the context is so important to understand what the Buddha is actually teaching. However, when awakened ones are present in the world, they bring light into the world. They teach the Dhamma that brings an end to stress. The wise will listen and regain their senses. It's the whole purpose of the Dhamma, isn't it? So that the wise will listen and regain their senses. They'll go from wrong view to right view. They'll go from suffering in the world to being free in the world. Let me read that, and just because it leads right into the next sentence. The wise will listen and regain their senses. They will clearly know impermanence as impermanence, stress as stress, and the unattractive as unattractive. Having developed right view, they abandon ignorance and bring to cessation all confusion, all deluded thinking, all stress and suffering. It's the end of that sutta. Thank you. That's quite a dramatic conclusion, isn't it, to that sutta? But it makes the point. The whole point of the Dhamma is to know these things. To know, the Buddha is also referring to, and I'm referring to, the three marks of existence here, isn't it? That's the insight that the Buddha teaches is gained through development of the Eightfold Path, a very specific insight. It's not insight into everything that arises. It's not insight into washing the dishes or anything like that. Insight into what is impermanent is impermanent. What is stressful is stressful. What is not self is not self. What is unattractive is unattractive. As we start developing the Dhamma, Lauren and I had a great discussion about this a little bit earlier. We have to start coming to grips with the idea that things that we felt were always attractive, because we implied permanence to these attractive things, are in fact unattractive simply because they're impermanent. The meditation on the charnel grounds, and I shouldn't even call it a meditation, the contemplation on the charnel grounds is a good example of this, and something that has been terribly misapplied in modern Buddhism, where the Buddha describes a decaying body after death. And people have taken that to, well, we should meditate on that. No, we shouldn't overemphasize it. But when you think about what happens to a body, even as it ages, and then certainly as soon as it dies, it starts decomposing, well, it'll become unattractive to us. We'll stop being so enamored with the physical form, and we'll understand the physical form as reality. It's a good tool to move through human life with, isn't it? But it's nothing to be attached to.
So
it's nothing to be enamored with.
The fusion of attractiveness and unattractiveness always goes back to impermanence.
Always, yeah. I had to think about that, but yeah.
Yeah.
It's because of fabricating permanence where impermanence is, including whatever is giving us pleasure,
why otherwise would we not see unattractiveness as an impermanence?
Yes. And do you see how that view is rooted in ignorance? Ignorance meaning we don't know something. We don't know the reality of impermanence. Do you see that? Is that because
no,
that's an important?
Can you just flesh out what?
Because we don't understand.
Wrong.
Because we don't understand the true nature of impermanence. Excuse me. And the views that we
What reason would we have to see something as attractive when in fact it is unattractive? What earthly reason would we have to do that?
That
we don't see that something that was once attractive has already turned, but we don't want to see the impermanence of it. That's why we cling to this idea of that it's still attractive.
There's nothing that we can find in the physical world. That's the world we live in. Now, we're not talking about mystical and magical here. You know, that's part of the problem with much of modern Buddhism. A practical approach to life. There's not one thing that we can point to that stays, that lasts. that's permanent, not one thing. And so the Buddha often described the problem of stress, right? Now take the broad overview. Stress is related to impermanence. Is that we join with stress. Another way of saying that is we cling to those things that are stressful. We create identities over what we need, we think we need, to maintain our happiness and our pleasure and our enjoyment and maybe our position and power in life. And we create aversion to anything that might take away from that. That's joining with stress because I need it. I want it this way. And because those views are rooted in ignorance of the way things truly are, it persists and ends up as creating, as the Buddha's words, all manner of confusion, deluded thinking, and ongoing suffering. And it's simply because we don't understand reality. So the big aha, the big understanding, is just past that veil of ignorance, that veil of delusion that we have.
Isn't the key to all of it accepting impermanence? Like, there's nothing wrong with being happy.
Oh, no.
Or pleasure, or like the sadness, the confusion, the delusion, the disappointment happens when you expect that beautiful blue sky to last forever.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
So it's just not clinging to the concept of impermanence.
Yes.
And
not insisting that. Not creating identities over certain conditions. Like, I have a friend of mine that they cannot stand rainy days. It just throws them into almost a depression. Because somewhere they got conditioned to believe that rainy days suck. Rainy days are just another, I like rainy days often. But
Mary just said that, and you create anatta, all of a sudden stands in there and starts to make decisions and doesn't even exist.
Yeah, there's no foundation to it, and so that can't help but create more stress, can it? We're allowing, again, relating to wrong views and impermanence, we're allowing views rooted in ignorance of the way things are to run our life. There's always got to be disappointment.
Lost their mind. Those things have been destroyed.
But the difference between a mind rooted in ignorance and a mind rooted in wisdom is within the same mind. That mind has recognized and abandoned the things rooted in ignorance. That's what the sutta is pointing to. It seems like, again, Laura and I were talking about it, we talk about it a lot here, it seems like annihilation. Like, how can I live my life without having these views? It seems like, I won't have any fun, I won't enjoy anything. It's really just the opposite. But you'll cease creating identities. You'll cease insisting that the world and your experience in the world be different than it possibly can be. It can't be that way.
You're
we can't create permanence of it.
Destroying a perverted reality.
Yes, Thanissara really used the right word. It is a perverted reality that we insist, once we've created an identity about this perverted reality and are now clinging to it, how can we let it go? How can we even recognize it? Because we fooled ourselves in believing that it's real. That's the purpose of an Eightfold Path. It's not enough to just say, okay, I'm living in a perverted reality, I'll meditate 24 hours a day and that'll be enough. It's not enough. In fact, I just came across an article that finally got into the medical aspects of improper meditation, and it showed very conclusively that meditation is nothing to be taken lightly. Many people have gotten very ill from just meditating. That'll be another talk. We need a framework rooted in a well-concentrated mind to recognize the nature of our own delusion or our fabrications or our perverted thinking. And so it doesn't mean that when we let go of all these wrong views, the world ends. Look at the life of the Buddha, but look at anybody, look at your own lives as you've developed the Dhamma and you become much more calm, much more peaceful, much more involved in your life, but much less attached to situations and outcomes.
It occurred to me that it's a process of, and maybe we've even said things like this, but it's a process of subtraction. And the who we are is what's left when the things that need to be subtracted or removed or eliminated or renounced whatever the word is, that's where, that's who we are. Is after all that is gone, what is left is that non-reactive, not attached to impermanence, not introducing anatta, having the thoughts under control so that the suffering is not occurring. So it works in my head that it's a subtraction. It's like what's left.
Yeah.
Not an annihilation, but what's left.
Yeah, that's a perfect description of it.
I would say along that line in what you were talking about something when you said when you and John were speaking about, it was reminding me that when once we start to go into the proliferation or joining that which is impermanent, so there's these moments of experience, but we're clinging and joining them and making them seem like they're permanent and contiguous, like there's a contiguous self, right, that wants more ice cream and chocolate cake, as you know, and that needs all that, but that's like that's dead. Like I love where he says, so beings were destroyed, they've lost their minds. So it's the opposite, like, so we're not, sometimes it feels like annihilation. There's this jig that, or like when you let go of something, but I think we've all had experiences of it, of it's so much more alive. We're actually dead when we're in the perverted state. We're missing so much of what's going on with our push and pull and you know, no rainy days. That's crazy. Like, you've just locked yourself in a prison. I mean, I've been there for sure, you know. I don't like to drive on 611.
Still?
You know, it's like a hard view, you know, driving like that. But, like, it doesn't matter. Like, so it's like you can have a little bit of lightheartedness about it, too, and let go. But so the truth is, absolutely, I think, you know, we've all had the experience of when we can let go of that, is so much more rich and vibrant and vitality available. So
it's almost like you don't even have a choice of letting go because it's impermanent.
Yeah, but wrong views maintain those.
Yeah.
Maintain the more use the word contiguous, the continuity, and so it seems like it's real because I got the same view I had. And because we've identified now with the views, we have to maintain the views. Anything that comes along now that will challenge the view is something we don't want anything part of. And that's really the biggest problem with developing the Buddhist teaching, because it challenges our views. It takes us from wrong view, a view rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths, characterized by fabrications or perverted thinking, to a mind free of that, free of any fabricated or perverted thinking, and just simply present. I mean, the big reward, and it's really what everybody wants, the big reward in the Dhamma is to simply have a meaningful experience, a mindful experience of life as our life unfolds. And think about that. What else could you want? What else is there? I mean, the Buddha teaches that along with, he said every human being needs four things along with his Dhamma, along with the awakened state. We need food, shelter, clothing, and medicine. We do. So this isn't a way to kind of just float around the cosmos. It's a practical way of living in the world without the need to have Imelda Marcos' shoes. Everybody, that's a strange reference, isn't it? Does anybody know what that reference is?
Yeah.
She had 10,000 pairs of shoes and she still wasn't happy. We learn to live in a very practical, mindful way, free of the need of our life to be any different than it is right now. Isn't that remarkable? And it took an awakened human being, a rightly self-awakened human being, to figure out how to do it by recognizing and abandoning all fabricated or all perverted views. And it's just that simple. It's just that direct. It's just that way. It's just that there. I don't know how many of you have ever read The Course in Miracles. It's an interesting read. There's an autobiography of Helen Schuckman called A Journey Without Distance. And the only reason I'm bringing it up is this is truly a journey without distance. It's within the same mind that's fabricated that awakening occurs.
Yeah.
It's not to say that there's an inner Buddha nature or a Buddhahood or any of that. It just means that this Dhamma applies to who we and what we are in this present moment. And that's where we engage in it. Like that saying that I often say, that if you're in New York and you want to go to Chicago and you think you're in Los Angeles, you're not going anywhere. The Dhamma puts you in your place. It allows you to see what's going on in your own mind so that you can change it. In the Bhadakarata Sutta, the Buddha says you learn, you gain the ability to think what you want to think when you want to think it, which means you gain the ability to think what is appropriate to what's occurring. And so if it's a wonderful moment, if it's a beautiful sunrise or sunset, you're elated by it because you're present with it. But when the sun sets, you're not upset. You don't need it to be any different. You're simply present. And now it's evening, and now it's morning, and now it's the next day. And now there's no more chocolate cake, and now the car broke down, and now I got a new car, and now I met a new friend, and now I lost a friend. It's all part of life. Birth, sickness, aging, and death. Not getting what you want, getting what you don't want. That's part of life. But we don't need it to be any different because I've let go of all wrong views that it can be different. So that's, you know, that's maybe that I should conclude with that. Maybe the most powerful single understanding I ever developed is that I can't make it any different. It's already occurred. It's already here. And then from that thought, it truly would be insane or fabricated to think that I could make it different. What I can do is attend to my mental, physical, and Dhamma-related needs as life occurs, meaning engage in right effort, and I can escape all of that. And I don't mean escape in a physical sense. I mean I can let it all go. I can put it all behind me, all those fabrications. That's what the Buddha's teaching me. What a remarkable teaching and a remarkable Dhamma and a remarkable Sangha to understand it. Any other questions or comments? And we'll go around the room too. Like,
one thing I was thinking is that you can't make what has just happened any different, but you can, in the choices you make in the next moment, you can make it different. Like, let's say,
yes,
you know, the wrong thing happened, or an unhealthy thing, or an unskillful thing happened, or harmful, or then it's right view that accepts what has happened, but has the wisdom to know what to do going forward so that those sort of things don't happen to you over and over again.
That's true and useful knowledge. What you're describing, the process the Buddha went through, as he described it in the Gara Sutta. He came to an understanding of the results of wrong views and the suffering that it brought him. And it's from understanding it, from now developing right view, you can learn from it. So again, we're not abandoning our entire life or anything like that, but we are learning from the framework of the Eightfold Path, and now we're talking about the moral and ethical aspects of right speech, right action, or right livelihood, by recognizing, by being mindful enough of when they're occurring, to know how hurtful they are. And that if we continue to engage in that way, we're only continuing our own ignorance and suffering.
Well, I think that's where some of the delusion and perversion occurs. When you know you're doing something that's unskillful, but you keep doing it, or holding on to it, or making it permanent, or bringing self into it, and repeating it, whether it's a lifestyle or, you know, any harmful behavior
practice. Yeah, and you do it because you now, you've joined with it. It's you. And even though you might know how, for years I lived in the bottom of a vodka bottle and some other chemicals too. But it never dawned on me that maybe, I'm sure it did occasionally, but I was so habituated to that I couldn't imagine not doing it, no matter how hurtful it was. And anybody that went through any type of addiction knows that. But we're all going through that. We're all creating stress and suffering in our lives by making choices rooted in ignorance. They might not be as exaggerated or grandiose as a compulsive person, but the results are the same, aren't they? And until we have a framework for recognizing that, and the Eightfold Path almost gives us the allowance to change our mind, because that's taking true refuge, isn't it? We understand that an awakened human being taught this, True refuge means that we've taken comfort and safety in something. And this awakened human being gave us his Dhamma to know how to do it. And that third refuge of having this incredibly supportive Sangha, it cannot be overlooked. It's part of that. I think next week I'm giving a talk on Ratana Sutta. And it's all by being mindfully observant of our own behavior in this framework of the Eightfold Path.
Look at what you're doing.
Yeah.
David and I were listening to something or talking about something and take a look at what you're doing. That is your practice.
Jiddu Krishnamurti, that's what he said that in many of the talks that he gave. Look at the life you're living. But of course, he usually left out the framework for doing so. But this is mindfulness. In this application, look at the life you're living, be mindful of the impermanence of all things, the not self characteristic that's taken over our minds, and the resulting suffering because of it.
I heard Thanissaro Bhikkhu say that something like, if ask yourself, if this is your last breath, have you done all the work you should be doing? And like that like brings it really home. Like, we contemplate death, and you know, I know that like the death contemplations are, you know, every day I'm always doing that. But like that question, if this is your last breath, is this decision you're gonna make like in the next moment really, really how you wanna spend your time? Because he says, think about where you've been, and this is something, I don't know if this is true or not, I'm gonna say this, but this came from Thomas Sorrow's mouth. But the Buddha said, think about where you've been and think about where you're going. Something like all the blood, this is terrible, but all the times your head has been chopped off as a cow, we don't have to believe in reincarnation, I'm just saying. As a cow, as a bird, as a murderer, as a this, as a that, and like all these things you've done, like do you want to go still stay in that cycle of life? Because we don't really want to see the suffering. I know that sounds crazy and that sounds mystical and stuff, but that, like, do you want to really, like, I don't think I know that I don't want to look at my suffering consistently. I would like to think that I would, and I don't have to go back to being a rooster in a past life if that ever happened, but it's just, like, it's only talking about being stuck in samsara, in a sense. But samsara doesn't sound so bad when you're eating cashews and chocolate cake and you've got a lovely house and, you know, a lovely wife, you know. So like sometimes these horrific scenes help me.
But it's the next moment. You started. It's your next moment, knowing whether you're on the path or not.
Yep.
So it's the same, whether you look at dependent origination as three lifetimes or one moment, it's really that next moment you have an opportunity to know whether you're on the path.
Yes, that's the important thing. It's right now. It's immediate.
Yes, you do have that, but sometimes I think I'll wait for the next moment.
But that's the common problem, more. That's
no.
Why we need to integrate
that's
the Eightfold Path, because
about.
We'll continue to delude
that's
ourselves.
Fabrication.
Yeah, that's the fabrication.
You're allowing the trick to obscure the reality.
Yeah, awakening sounds like a good idea. I'll do it tomorrow. I'm enjoying myself too much right now to awaken now. Tomorrow's a good time. That's great. David, how are you tonight? Good to see you.
I just think these little quick suttas are just right to the point that these aggregates, what you are, that to do anything but to see them as what you are, what you're made up of, that's the fabrication.
Okay.
And each moment on the cushion, you have those glimpses of the true reality. It's when you're truly present, and then when something bubbles up, that's just a reflection of the fabrication. So when you get off the cushion, then you start seeing those moments as that stringing together of your life.
Yeah.
So the practice, I mean, it, it really does develop that wisdom to not just recognize it, but then just to start living it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it's not perfect, because it's a path, it's a practice. So, you know, I look forward to getting on the cushion and getting off the cushion and living within that framework.
Yeah.
Much easier.
Thank you. You're describing joyful engagement, aren't you? Mm-hmm. It is. It's just remarkable. Mm-hmm. This and its work is. It's. I keep saying it's simple. It is simple. It's hard at times, but look at the rewards.
Mm-hmm.
You actually get to live a life. Thank you, Lorna. Good to see you this evening.
Good to be here. I can relate to what Maura was saying, that she'd delay the happiness until tomorrow. You know? just go with the flow and start the work tomorrow. We have a bit more in common than I thought. But I listened to this sutta on Saturday, and since then I can't tell you how many times that I reflected on what brings you pleasure,
mm-hmm.
brings you stress. It's just the flip side. If the further pleasure you go down that road, you know, the bigger the bump at the end.
Mm-hmm.
And I've thought about that many times since Saturday. It's sort of really made a big difference in the way I'm thinking, and which is ultimately really understanding reality,
yeah.
which we delude ourselves from. Remember that, Maura.
Yeah. I exaggerate a little bit.
That's about all I can really think of just now. Oh, and another thing I have been more conscious of as well, and I don't know if this is related or not. When you're meditating, there are, like David says, the times when you really get in the flow and you really abandon yourself and your anatta. But a lot of the time, there's a thread of anatta still there.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm seeing more clearly how just how even disruptive to my mind that thin tiny little bit of thread is, that it just won't, you just always can't quench it even on the meditation cushion. And I have been a little bit more conscious of that and understanding of trying a bit harder on your cushion to really, really get it out of your mind. I mean, you can only try a bit harder, and not criticize yourself, but just understand that little bit of thread is exactly a little bit of thread that's got to go.
Mm-hmm.
And so I've been working and understanding that since Saturday, and I don't know if that's related or not, as I say.
Oh, it's related directly. Thank you. To recognize that even a little remnant of ignorance is still going to create some stress in your life. That's remarkable. That's the insight we're looking for. If me or someone else told you 3 years ago that it's ignorance of Four Noble Truths that's causing all your trouble, you'd think that was the most insane thing you ever heard.
Mm-hmm.
But now you have the context for recognizing even a shred of ignorance. You know, the Buddha might say it this way, that the wise know the danger in even the most minor transgression. That's what he's referring to. And again, it doesn't mean that there's something wrong if there's still a shred of ignorance. It's just we're fortunate, and it should encourage our joyful engagement to be able to recognize that we can continue to move forward, and we have a framework for doing it. So thank you. Rob, good to see you tonight.
Good to be here. No, I'm glad I was trying to split this, because it's the whole idea of the fabrications have always been kind of a vague thing. Yes, I've heard it a million times, but this really lays it out. I was surprised to see in that last four was that, and the last thing he mentions is attractiveness and unattractiveness. because they're really both parts of wrong view.
Yeah.
To be attracted, I mean, it's clinging or aversion. That's what it signifies.
Yeah, that's right.
I'm not to chew on that a little bit.
Thank you. Yeah, that is. That's the essence of clinging. You know? We don't recognize it. We're clinging to stress. We're joined with stress. Whether it's we see it as unattractive or attractive, it's still the results are the same.
Yeah. But it showing up as the last thing, it kind of means that you're... I'm trying to go back to the text now. I can't. That one is better than the other. But it actually isn't.
Yeah, the sutta is saying that it's basically it's the same thing, that you have
mm-hmm.
it you have it confused,
yeah.
And there's not even a relationship. Let's use the word permanence and impermanence.
Mm-hmm.
There's not even a relationship except in the negative. This is why I say the Buddha taught via negativa to show what was a wrong view, but just because the opposite of there's no connection except in the difference between wrong view and right view.
The opposite of a wrong view is still a wrong view.
Yes, that's right. Yeah. Yeah. And there's the feedback loop the Buddha was talking about in the Nagara Sutta. And a self-referential or self-reflective view wants to see things that way in competition. Or, okay, if I can't have this, then I'll have that. Well, guess what? If you want to be stress-free, you can't have any of it because it's all rooted in wrong views. Thank you for that, putting that out. That's great. Kevin, good to see you tonight.
Good to see you, John. Nice to be here. Appreciate the talk, and I don't think I have anything to add. I'm sitting in open silence.
I'm glad you're here. Helen, good to see you tonight.
Thank you. Good to be here. The thing that strikes me is the discrete space between opposites. Lao Tzu has all of these beautiful quotes, and they usually are based on opposites. Not seeing is seeing. And David said something about he treasures the time on the cushion and off the cushion. And just that those moments in between, right view, wrong view, off the path, on the path. And so it's that little tipping point to be non-reactive, but to have a choice.
Yeah.
So we can be non-reactive about something, but we're actually making a choice, which is an active thing, to be where we are. So it's that discrete little space in between, which is the middle way.
What a great way of putting it. That you're describing the term stream enter is always a little bit difficult to describe, but you're describing it. Whether you're in the moment experiencing the results of wrong view because you're mindful of right view, you understand it, and you understand you're in this process of awakening. Then it's all meaningful, isn't it? Thank you. That's wonderful. Mary, good to see you tonight.
Good to be here, John. Good to be here with everyone. It occurred to me listening to Saturday, just, I think I've said something similar to this before, but just the importance of that this is a commitment, and whether it's called a spiritual practice or not, but it's a full practice of, you know, certainly being here, but what you do in your meditation, the discipline that you bring to it, any reading or investigation that you can do to take your inquisitive mind further in your understanding in between Tuesdays now.
Yeah.
And really investing in it. And, you know, like, I don't mean to compare it to a religion at all, but some of the things that I valued as a child being brought up in a specific spiritual practice were the things that helped me return to my center, you know, that you know, different things that I was taught that helped me stay on a path or view the world appropriately or, you know, understand my parents or understand the world or right and wrong, you know, things that all might carry heavier words to people today. But this fits, this kind of comes into that same portal for me of it's worth dedicating the time and the energy in order to reap the benefits or to have more of those moments where you're in a moment, you have poise and pause, and you're making the right choice. You know, you're having clear right view, and that right choice is something that's taking you closer to awakening versus something that might be pleasurable or attractive or other things that might be taking you, that are, you know, I'm making, that your anatta is making that decision. And I certainly don't always put in, you know, as much effort as I could, but I think that that can be a missing component if it's not fully integrated and if you're willing to sort of take that next step for every day and investigation and you know, just a real effort, real right effort about this whole practice. I just think that's always an opportunity for myself, for sure.
Yeah, for all of us, thank you. Yeah, I think the Buddha's also referring to here, you mentioned it, the spiritual practice, he's also referring to recognizing things that are outside of his Dhamma that don't lead to the goal of awakening, to see those, to see the unattractive in the attractiveness of that too, and recognize that, it's just as important. So, thank you very much. Natalie, good to see you tonight.
Love you too, I'm just observing tonight.
I'm glad you're here. Mary Beth, good to see you. I'm glad you're here too. And you'll get back to me with a date or a couple of dates. Good, thank you. Maura, good to see you tonight.
Good to be here. I just really, I agree with Ram and everything everybody has said. This sutta is just really crystal clear. Again, and you have said you edited it down, so thank you. I've heard the parts of it and such, and I just love how clear and simplified it is. Very, very succinct. So, yeah. And then I guess, you know, I mean, I know I joke around a lot, you know, that's probably whatever old stuff. But, maybe some view about sounding so like I got, you know, one's got it all together. And so that being said, you know, I do take this practice very seriously. And I find that, in fact, over the past few months, and without, you know, at the risk of anatta speaking, so the practice, just watching the fruits of the practice, really blossom in a beautiful way in daily life has been surprising, because sometimes it feels like that's not happening. But just like some, so anyway, I would say I in the morning I usually kind of really focus in during my sit, after my sit, like what aspect of the path I really want to keep mindful besides all the other mindful, beautiful path, you know. But really, like, ooh, okay, kind of seeing the day and how does that play out, and seeing more clearly my relationships in throughout my daily life and the contribution that I bring positively and negatively. So I can't see really reality as it's unfolding because I have some view about what I need to get done or what somebody else needs to do, you know. And so this you've said it so many times, John, but like this, the piece of just watching unfold any resistance to what is unfolding in myself or in another person, wanting that to be different, and just kind of like meeting what's arising with a sense of open-heartedness. Mm-hmm. And I was trying to think how I could make it succinct, because I was thinking about just an incident that happened at work today with a resident who was just, she was in distress. And I know sometimes that our views, my fabrications or perversions, I think all of us have it because of our conditioning of what's right and wrong. This shouldn't be happening, that shouldn't be happening. Rainy days or sunsets, even a sunset. Who's to say a sunset is beautiful? That's our conditioning. Like, you know, for somebody else, that sunset might not be beautiful. But so in this case, there was, you know, could have been a view of somebody being not caring about a woman who was in distress and crying out. And like being open to kind of just like letting go of that view. So at the same time, being able, so I guess what I'm saying is I had a view that something shouldn't be happening, somebody shouldn't be doing X, letting go of that, and still the action to meet that pain and suffering and what needed to be done was so natural. Like, so sometimes you think like if you let go of a view, like, are you going to be passive? But instead, there was like just that kind of natural action. A hand gets hurt, you pick it up, you know, kind of thing. And then a real sense of like tenderness towards all the other people involved. And that, I kept thinking about that. I mean, not kept thinking, it was popping up in my meditation. Yeah. So letting go of views still allows one to act a lot more cleanly to meet suffering when it can be allayed.
Yeah. Thank you. It's curious that we think we need to maintain wrong views in order to take action in the world. It's just the opposite. Russ, good to see you tonight.
See you. Yeah, I think one of the biggest things I've learned in the recent months is about impermanence and how freeing that is to know that.
Yeah.
Because you stop trying to make things, you know, happen the way you want them to happen. It's freeing. Like, you know, when you're going through bad stuff or bad things happen, it's impermanent. It's not going to last forever. And the funny thing is, the happy times and the good times, you might think, well, it's a downer because it's impermanent. It's not going to last, but it actually makes you enjoy it more.
Yeah.
So, it's been good.
Yeah, thank you for that. Yeah, we appreciate what's occurring because it's occurring. And when it's good, it's even better. Liz, good to see you.
Good to see you. Good to be here. Enjoy. I'm listening to everyone tonight.
Me too.
So it's another reminder of making choices about becoming. What am I going to become in this moment? And that's a good one to remind me of. What am I becoming in this moment?
Yeah, for all of us. We might as well become awakened in this moment.
Or become Buddha.
Hence the name of the book. Thank you. Thank you all. There was two quick announcements. I can only think of one. Our retreat's coming up, September 20th to the 23rd. If you're going, please register as soon as you possibly can. It helps me with the logistics, et cetera, and the financial anniversaries I have to meet. What was the other one? No, but you know, now that you said that, I would appreciate any feedback if you come across something. I'm in the process now of setting up the website so it's more conducive to the app and how it displays on a smartphone, and that's going to take me a little time. But any suggestions you have, you know, just feel free to send them to me. That'd be great. And it might be asking one or two of you to look at a. I have to put it out to the group. I kind of rewrote. I rewrote. more or less the page for new visitors. And if any of you want to read it and send me some feedback, David, I would appreciate it. But from all of you, I really would appreciate it. The point is not just for beginners. It's really for anybody who gets to the website to start there, and that page would point them in the right direction. Because the website over the years has grown to, there's 400, more than 400 talks, more than 300 videos linked, and over 250 articles. So, and, you know, it's got, yeah, it is. Thank you. And if it wasn't for preparing for a class, now three classes a week, most of that wouldn't be there. So it's really all of your creation. So thank you all for that.
The app actually looks very clean on the phone. I find it much easier to navigate. So I couldn't confirm what tonight's class was about. I thought I could.
Well, you got me thinking more. I might put that up.
You don't need another layer of that. But you know, you are a newcomer and you're trying to see what the topic you want to read up on it.
I might figure out. It's really just another thing that I have to put in each week, but not, I don't resent it. It's just, it is. It does. I put a lot of time into that, but it's well worth it. Can't think of the other one, so we might as well finish. We'll finish with. Thank you. Yeah, the problem still is with some of the web fonts. The fonts are still a little bit too big for a smartphone, but I'm working through that. But again, any suggestions you ever have, please send them to me.
Not when I open it.
Depending on how good your eyesight is, but to me it was
Too big was a thing.
Well, yeah, but when Mr. Magoo is designing that, you got to be a little careful.
And when I say it looks beautiful, it's not the aesthetics. It's just kind of clean and easier, right? It's easier.
What do you mean? You don't like the aesthetics?
Of course I do, but I used to over-focus on that, and
all the little boxes.
Yeah, but the content, like, it feels more spacious and very clear about where you're going. So.
Yeah, but I guess the underlying design thought was to keep it as distraction-free as possible, because all, you know, it's information.
It is
out there.
A lot of
information. Yeah. It really is. I know it sounds self-aggrandizing. It's a remarkable website. I know I said it to Maura. I wish I had come across this website 20 years ago.
You would have never made it out of your house.
Crank up the time machine.
There was a guy. He was 22 when I saw him.
There's some obsessions that are good, I think.
We appreciate your obsession.
Being obsessed with the Buddhist Dhamma is, I think, a good thing. Let's finish with metta, as we always do. So find your relaxed meditation posture and gently close your eyes and gently close your mouth. And take a moment to become mindful of your in-breath and your out-breath. These are the Buddha's words on metta from the Karaniya Metta Sutta. This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied. Unburdened with duties and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm and wise and skillful, not proud or demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove. Wishing in gladness and in safety, may all beings be at ease. Whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be at ease. Let none deceive another or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another. Even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings. Radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded, freed from hatred and ill will. Whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness, one should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding. by not holding to fixed views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being freed from all sense desires, is not born again into this world. Thank you all for a wonderful class tonight. Peace.
Thank you for listening. I rely on donations to support these talks. If you find benefit from these talks, please consider a donation at becoming-buddha.com. I welcome your questions and comments. To contact me and for guided meditations and instructions, Dhamma articles, recorded talks, and videos, please visit becoming-buddha.com. These talks are copyrighted and are distributed under a Creative Commons License 4.0. Peace.